From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. We're following the news out of Britain, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson has resigned, although he hasn't left office. We're also keeping an eye on the rise of the far right here in the U.S. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is promising to examine the links between former President Trump's advisors and extremists. And Boston is the latest city investigating the white supremacist group, the Patriot Front, after members held a march in town last weekend and allegedly attacked a black artist activist. Members of the same group were stopped in Idaho last month. Officials say they were planning to disrupt a pride parade. The Patriot Front is one of the groups that launched the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Back then, they were called Vanguard America, and they wore white shirts and khakis. Well, now they wear blue shirts with neck gaiters covering their faces. Pete Simme is a professor at Chapman University in California. He testified in a trial that led to a $26 million verdict against organizers of that rally in Charlottesville. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm wondering, what are you thinking today? I mean, writing in the pages of the Boston Globe today, the attorneys who brought that lawsuit in Virginia called the march in Boston last weekend a wake-up call. But, you know, has this phone been ringing for a while? Do you agree we're not paying attention?
Well, it's been ringing off the hook for years and years, and the threat is large. It's been large for a long time, and the near future poses a lot of risk.
Well, here in Boston, the police are being criticized. People said they didn't respond fast enough. They are investigating, but they've also said it's hard to know what to do. If you go to one of these pop-up rallies, which seem to be the trend, are you seen as accompanying them? Do you incite more violence? How do you respond? But first of all, what is the alarm? Because we know the Patriot Front's motto is Reclaim America for White People. In Idaho, one of the members carried a manifesto. Police said looked like a military plan. What is it that they are about that should be alarming?
They're basic underlying beliefs, while they may claim publicly that this is not the case, support violence, support the necessity to use violence to, as they say, reclaim the country, to reclaim America, to defend the white race. Patriot Front is active nationwide. These folks are leafleting, holding these kinds of marches across the country. They're on social media. So, you know, I think we can do a lot more to be prepared for when these folks come to town.
Well, after Charlottesville, the same white supremacist announced a rally in Boston, and it was scheduled. And as a result, thousands of counter-protesters showed up and literally, you know, booed them out of town. But now we have this kind of flash mob aspect to things, as I said. Harder to know when they're going to pop up. Do you think that they are growing in size? We know they're recruiting on college campuses. Tell us more about your sense of what we're talking about here. How many people?
Yeah, I mean, the estimates back in 2019 put it at around 300 members. It seems to be growing since then over the last few years. You're correct in terms of the recruitment on college campuses. We've seen their propaganda where I work at Chapman University on several occasions. That's happening across the country as well. We're seeing the recruitment of folks in the military. So, and I think it's important to understand the Patriot Front is part of a larger threat landscape. It's not just the Patriot Front in the singular, it's the plural that they represent in terms of this threat to democracy.
Meaning what?
Meaning we are dealing with a massive movement. It's a global movement. There's certainly a national context to it. We saw it manifest itself in terms of January 6th insurrection. We saw it Charlottesville, a deadly rally there. We're seeing it with these single actor attacks all over the country. Obviously, Buffalo, El Paso, Pittsburgh, time and time again, we're seeing those incidents of violence kind of written off as a single lone deranged actor instead of an actual movement that's promoting this kind of violence that is really getting mainstreamed. So this is quite a situation we've gotten ourselves into.
There's quite a web that you're weaving. I mean, you're drawing lines from different incidents to this kind of thinking. Can you draw it to Highland Park? We spoke to Ben Collins from NBC, who also takes deep dives into this world. He describes that shooter as being deep in an online world of accelerationists. People wanting to what? Accelerate this endgame?
Yeah, accelerate the violence, accelerate the destruction of society. Deconstruct the society as Steve Bannon has advocated, former White House advisor President Trump, right? So the accelerationist ideas run deep across a wide web. You're right. This is a very broad web, and we need to see the connections. This is not isolated to a singular group or set of individuals, but the accelerationist ideas have been prominent for quite some time among white supremacists and are taking hold more broadly.
That's pretty chilling. Pete Simme, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Chapman University, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's a new day in British politics. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he is resigning as head of the ruling Conservative Party, as he is under tremendous pressure. Officials and aides from Johnson's own party have been quitting almost by the hour. He says he will stay on as prime minister until the party chooses a new leader. Let's patch into London, where NPR's Frank Langfitt is. Frank, how did Boris Johnson explain his decision?
Yeah, Scott, it was really interesting. He blamed his own Conservative Party lawmakers for abandoning him and making him do this. He called it an eccentric decision of theirs to push him out. He referred to them as a herd, and he did not acknowledge the many scandals that he created himself. And he said he didn't want to leave because he wanted to keep serving the British people, and this is how he put it.
The reason I have fought so hard in the last few days to continue to deliver that mandate in person was not just because I wanted to do so, but because I felt it was my job, my duty, my obligation to you to continue to do what we promised in 2019.
Well, Frank, how is Boris Johnson's version of events landing with the public? Do they buy it?
No, not at all. I mean, Johnson is famously ambitious, even by political standards here, and far less focused on things like policy and programs. And in recent days, everybody here pretty much saw him as clinging to power, even though it was clear that the party, his party, wanted him out. And the fact is, you know, he could step down today and have a caretaker manage the government, but he's chosen not to. He's chosen to stay against the objections of a number of people.
Right. And as far as him staying, what support does he appear to have from his party, from the people?
I think that it's probably things will probably pan out that he'll stay for a while. But there were a lot of complaints today. The opposition Labour Party insisted that he leave. This is not a great surprise. And they threatened to call a no-confidence vote in the House of Commons, trigger a general election. But the former Conservative Prime Minister, John Major, he said Johnson should go. He says it's unwise for him to stay in office, and pointed out that he could continue to dole out patronage positions and make important decisions affecting the country at, you know, a really challenging time.
Frank, you have been watching, covering Boris Johnson now for years. How do you think about his legacy?
Well, I think there are some clear accomplishments. The vaccine rollout here, Scott, was very fast. And I mean, I saw that firsthand. We benefited from that. The whole country did. I think winning this massive election victory that he referred to back in 2019 for the Tory party was huge. And moving quickly to arm Ukraine, which I can tell you from my time reporting in Ukraine, he is wildly popular there. But he made so many mistakes, which he didn't really talk about today. You know, we all remember, he didn't take COVID very seriously at the beginning. He joked about it and ended up getting it and ending up in intensive care unit.
Right.
He allowed his own staff to throw parties while the rest of the country was banned from doing that. And then when confronted about it, didn't tell the truth. And, you know, I was talking to Nicholas Allen. He teaches politics at Royal Holloway, University of London. And here's how he sees it.
His main legacy is having won a large landslide. Yes, he made some progress on the Brexit process, but his overwhelming legacy will be one of dishonesty, lots of promises that were going nowhere.
So, Frank, who's looking in the Conservative Party to replace Boris Johnson, and what kind of challenges might that person inherit?
Yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of people who are going to jump into this. Boris Johnson leaves a big political vacuum here. Here's some people I'm kind of interested in, but I'm sure there'll be more. Ben Wallace, he's the defense secretary here. The UK, as I was mentioning, was the fastest country in Europe to arm Ukraine and had the toughest words for Putin even before the war. Wallace handles himself pretty well publicly, although he doesn't have a high profile here. It's not clear he actually wants the job. Rishi Sunak, he's the former Chancellor of the Exchequer. That's like the UK Treasury Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
He resigned on Tuesday. He urged Johnson to step down. I'll say this about Sunak. During the pandemic, he put together this very generous, and it was expensive for the government, a furlough program that benefited more than 11 million workers, and it saved countless businesses. And another person to watch is Sajid Javid. He's former health secretary. He kicked off the resignations that toppled Johnson, and he gave a very compelling speech yesterday in the House of Commons. I think it's worth noting that both Sunak and Javid, they're both children of South Asian immigrants, and every UK prime minister previously has been white. Of course, there are lots of challenges. Record inflation right now, the war in Ukraine. Whoever gets the job is going to have their hands full.
NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, thank you.
Hey, good to talk, Scott.
Is the late, great Leonard Cohen singing with chorus his best-known song, Hallelujah. Cohen first recorded it in 1984, and since then it has been performed by Bob Dylan, K.D. Lang, John Bon Jovi. In fact, I was at a bat mitzvah this spring where we all sang it. But Cohen is much more than Hallelujah. His song, Who by Fire, is a version of a Hebrew prayer.
And who by fire, who by water, who in the sunshine, who in the nighttime, who by high ordeal.
There's a new documentary film that takes a deep dive into the life of Leonard Cohen. It's called Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song, and it opens in theaters this month. We have longtime music journalist Larry Ratso Sloman joining us. He appears in the film, and he interviewed Cohen numerous times over three decades. Ratso Sloman, welcome.
Nice to be here, Scott.
Now, many of us, including me, associate Leonard Cohen with Hallelujah. But my goodness, he was so much more than this colossal anthem of our time. Renaissance man, spiritual man, poet, monk. How did he first strike you?
Well, I first met him when I was a young reporter for Rolling Stone magazine, and I was assigned to go to the Bottom Line, where he was playing two nights in to see him. And do a, you know, an article about Leonard. And what struck me was how much effort and how much, there's inspiration, of course, and then there's also perspiration. And I think the reason that we bonded is that we were basically two Jewish workaholics. And we saw something similar in each other because he had trepidations about playing live because, you know, he had been a poet for years in Montreal, and he was good at doing that and doing poetry readings. But, you know, playing live in front of people scared him. The first time he did it, when Judy Collins, who was his mentor, brought him on stage.
Jumping in here, we have a little bit of sound of exactly what you're describing. Let's take a listen.
And Judy kind of talked me into doing this. And she invited me out on stage, and I started singing, and the guitar was completely out of tune. And I was scared anyways. So rather than humiliate myself, I left.
He said, I just can't do this. And he walked off the stage.
Does this capture a page of Leonard Cohen? He went through book after book of notes and lyrics and ideas before he was satisfied.
Absolutely. And, you know, Leonard was also a spiritual chameleon. At one point, he tried Scientology. He had explored all different things. He finally wound up being a Jewish Zen Buddhist. But what struck me also that, you know, I became obsessed during this assignment. And, like, I followed him back to his hotel room after the first night, and we did more interviewing, and then went back the next day for the second show. And what struck me so much, it was so prescient to me. Okay, so the show was over, and the audience was wild. They loved it. And I went back with Leonard to the little tiny dressing room, and Leonard slumped there, And he was so thrilled with the reception he got from the audience. And he said to me, this would be so great if I was able to continue doing this and to kind of bring the wisdom of the ages. You know,
I was to continue to do this. He had doubts.
Yeah. And to be an elder is basically what he was talking about. So to me, you know, that's what Leonard became. I mean, Leonard became an elder to a whole generation, multiple generations of people. And, you know, I used to measure my life sometimes by Leonard's lyrics. In one song of his, Tower of Song, he said, I ache in the places that I used to play. And when I got to be about 60 years old, I said, I get it. That's what Leonard meant.
Well, my friends are gone. And my hair is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play. And I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming home. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song.
We have to talk about Hallelujah and its journey. In the documentary, the producer John Lissauer, who collaborated with Leonard Cohen, produced the album called Various Positions. Let's take a quick listen.
Columbia had asked that we do a record that would put Leonard on the American map. And we had this song, Hallelujah, which was pop song-like, and it reached out more. It just had a more contemporary possibility to it.
And yet this album, it was not released in America?
Well, I'll tell you the story, because after the first article, Leonard and I bonded, and I'm meeting him for coffee in Soho, and he starts telling me, he says, you know, I have this song, Hallelujah, and I've been just tearing my hair out. I've been sitting in my underwear just to get this song right. it's like hundreds of verses, right?
And there's something like 150, 180 verses, something on that order?
I mean, I guessed 180, but it could have been, you know, 150, yeah. Could have been. At any rate, so then he told me the story of bringing the album to Walter Yetnikoff, who was the head of Columbia Records at that time. Yetnikoff basically said to Leonard, we know you're great, we just don't know if you're any good. And he started ripping the album apart. And he decided he would not release the album in the domestic U.S. Of course, they would release the album all over Canada and all over Europe because it would make tons of money there. But in the United States, he just didn't want to release the album.
Well, Hallelujah, though, it eventually came into the public consciousness. It was covered by Bob Dylan. There's a famous version by John Cale.
Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair, she broke your throne, she cut your hair, and from your lips she drew the hallelujah.
John didn't really know Leonard's work that well at that point. But Cale and I went to see Leonard at the Beacon Theater, and that's where Cale saw flipped out when he heard Leonard do Hallelujah. Except it was not the same version of the song that was on the album. The album's song is much more spiritual, King David and all these Old Testament references. And when Leonard started doing it live, he had changed and used all whole other verses, and they made him much more secular and sexy. So I told John, you know, it'd be great if you could do both the spiritual and the secular. And then Cale, of course, did a beautiful version of putting the best of both, you know, some of the spiritual and the secular verses. And it was fantastic. And then, of course, Jeff Buckley did a version. Really broke the song was this cartoon character, Shrek.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you said, it went on from there to bar mitzvahs to weddings to funerals to buskers on the subway.
Yeah, everywhere. My son's high school choral group.
At one point, Leonard made a cheeky comment, which was, you know, I think people should give this song a rest. We've had enough versions.
I saw that. Did he mean it?
No, of course not. I mean, I think Leonard was actually thrilled that he got some kind of retribution against these Philistines at the record company who didn't want to, you know. So, I mean, and look, any artist, Dylan, him, anybody wants to communicate. When you communicate and a song can be embraced by such a variety of different people around the world, then you know, you've really done your job.
Yeah. Leonard Cohen passed in 2016, in the fall of 2016. You're a writer. Give me a few words that come to your mind when you describe Leonard Cohen.
Number one is the Jewish term mensch, which is just a wonderful human being. He was humble. He was caring, not only about people's feelings, but he cared about the work. And somebody who, you know, didn't become, you know, an elitist. You know, he really was a man of the people, and he was a terrific friend, and, you know, I just miss him dearly. Mm.
Music journalist Larry Ratso-Sloman appears in the new documentary Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song. Ratso-Sloman, thanks so much. Great pleasure.
Thanks, Scott. Take care.
And we leave you with Brandi Carlile's version of Hallelujah. In the film, she talks about what it meant to her as a young, spiritual, gay person. Hallelujah, it was hallelujah, hallelujah, and hallelujah, hallelujah, hey, hallelujah. Our staff is trying to decode the latest economic signals. Let's just say we haven't cracked anything yet. There are the up arrows when it comes to, say, job openings, and down arrows suggesting the economy is slowing a bit and that purchases of mortgages, computer chips, and copper are falling off, which is good as far as inflation, right? Yeah, we're still decoding. And we need some guidance from Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hey, Ali.
Hey, Scott, I'm looking for guidance myself at the moment on this particular issue because there are a lot of mixed signals going on in the economy.
Yeah, well, you know, I ask the questions, you give the answers. Come on. Boris Johnson's resignation. The resignation did not spook stock investors in London or New York, it seems. So how can stocks be up even though many people are expecting a recession?
Yeah, so it's a lot of things. It's a lot of factors. You're right that Boris Johnson's resignation, because it was seen as obvious and coming, you know, what the stock market doesn't like is surprises. It can handle change. So you've got that's happened. In fact, the British pound was up a little bit against the dollar. Stock markets are up right now, but they've been choppy generally. The issue is, as you said, inflation and the labor market, right? Those are the two issues that the Fed looks at. It's the issues that everybody looks at. There are still about 11.3 million job openings in the United States. They're down a little bit from when they were in April, but they're still very high. That's a lot of job openings. Workers continue to be quitting their jobs at a near record pace, but we are seeing a bit of an increase in new claims for unemployment and some evidence that hiring is starting to slow down. And in fact, there is anecdotal evidence in a few places that people are even being laid off or there are hiring freezes. So it's a very, very confused signal. It's not, there's no particular economic signal right now that is showing the same signs across the board. It's regional, it's different depending on what the industry is.
Well, can we geek out for a moment on the Federal Reserve? The minutes from the last meeting are just out. And of course, the Fed made a big boost in short-term interest rates to pump the brakes on the economy. And these minutes suggest they're interested in what they call a restrictive stance. You speak Fed. Can you translate?
Yeah, look, they're trying to... This is a tough situation for the Fed because, generally speaking, when the Fed raises interest rates, it slows the economy down, right? That's like hitting the brakes on the economy. It costs more money to borrow, and as a result, mm-hmm. individuals spend a little less on their credit card. They save a little bit more. It becomes more attractive to put your money in a savings account, and businesses also slow down. On the other hand, these things sometimes take a year or a year and a half to play out in the market, and the Fed is trying to deal with things that are happening right now. So there's a lot of criticism that the Fed might be acting too quickly and too much. They keep raising interest rates, and they've said that it might happen some more. People are worried that they'll slow the economy down too much. So that's where the Fed is right now. It's between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't want out-of-control inflation, but it doesn't want to be the Fed that brought the recession on.
And quickly, can we expect some prices to ease a little bit, I don't know, gas prices or at the grocery store?
Yeah, look, ultimately, all of these things will ease over time. The issue is that they're all piling up at the same time. It does have the necessary effect of having people slow down on their spending, so that alone will pull pressure down a little bit. But yeah, look, this is going to be a rocky few months. We'll probably know in 3 months or 4 months, looking in the rearview mirror, whether the right choices were made. But for right now, we've still got low unemployment and we've still got high inflation.
Ellie Belshi, MSNBC, thank you.
My pleasure.
In a moment, we're going to hear from one of the recipients of the Medal of Freedom, the country's highest civilian honor given out at the White House today. But first, let's recognize four veterans who received the highest military award, the Medal of Honor, on Tuesday.
President Biden presented the medal to Specialist 5 Dwight W. Birdwell, Specialist 5 Dennis M. Fuji, and retired Major John J. Duffy, and posthumously to Staff Sergeant Edward N. Kaneshiro. He was killed in action 3 months after the incident for which he received this honor. All four veterans of the Vietnam War.
They stood in the way of danger, risked everything, literally everything, to defend our nation and our values. However, not every service member has received the full recognition they deserve. Today, we're setting the record straight.
Each of these veterans had previously received awards for their service, but now they have achieved the highest recognition for their valor.
Hear, hear. Well, today at the White House, President Biden presents 17 Americans with the country's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, awarded to individuals who've made exemplary contributions to American life and culture. On this list of honorees, gymnast Simone Biles, soccer star Megan Rapinoe, gun safety activist and former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, actor Denzel Washington, the late Senator John McCain, and others, including educator Dr. Julieta Garcia. She's now a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, was former and first female president of the University of Texas at Brownsville, where she grew up, and the first Latina to head any American university. Dr. Garcia, congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
And what do you think? You know, you get a phone call or however you find out, oh, you're getting a Medal of Freedom honor.
I had been warned that I should accept a call from a 202 area code. And I thought, well, that's nice. And I was hoping it would be, please serve on an advisory committee on fill in the blank, hopefully immigration, the tough, tough issues. So I was in the garden, and I missed the call once and twice. And finally, the third time, I responded. And there was a very excited young lady on the other side of the phone, and she's saying, the president wanted to tell you personally, and he's tried to call you twice. And I'm thinking, this is a joke. The president has been trying to call you. And she said, but he had to go overseas. Well, yeah, to the G7 summit. Anyway, she said, so I'm calling you, because he would like to let you know that you've been selected by him to receive the Medal of Freedom.
Well, talk about what that means. And a little bit of your backstory. Mexican-American, born in Brownsville, Texas. Your father's family fled the Mexican Revolution. On your mother's side, you're fifth generation. I'm sure you're thinking of them today. Talk a little about their challenges, their sacrifices.
Their story is our story because my father and his family started a new life here in the United States and so came over with nothing. They had to leave everything behind. They were very lucky to get out with their lives. But he did very well. He started school in Mexico, did well in school in the United States. But because he graduated from high school during the Depression, he never could go away to college. My mother had gone to high school, and she had done well. She was salutatorian, which is unheard of many years ago. And yet, she didn't go to college for the same reason. So there was this hunger. And they said their children were all going to go to school. So that was the backdrop to our becoming who we became, my brothers and I. It was understood from the day we were born that we were going to go to college. Dad and mother had a savings account. Dad would put in $10 a month for each one of us. We didn't know what college was, but we knew it must be really important.
I think that was raised at one point to $20. And
It was.
Yeah, you talk about this in a great TEDx talk. We'll link people to it at hereandnow.org. But, you know, there were times when, you know, you all lived very modestly. And as a little girl, your mom passed at 40 from cancer. Mm-hmm. But you're a little girl, the only girl in the family. Can we have another bathroom, please? Can't we break into that account? No. What would your father say to you and your brothers when you said this?
Ese dinero no se toca. That money won't be touched unless you use it to go to college.
Yeah. Even when your brothers threatened to, I'm leaving home and I want my part of the college savings. He says, no, you leave home, you don't get it. Your brother stayed.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, my father said, I never got to go. So I'll use yours. And I'll go back to college.
Back.
Of course, my brother stayed home and went to college.
Well, you know, obviously this is just in your DNA, how important education is. And you've been passing this on to other students. I just want to ask about the other aspect of your parents. I mean, you tell about your mom, even though her family owned a store in Brownsville.
Yes.
She had to live on the other side of the tracks in the segregated Mexican community, who could only swim in the pool one day a year, and then after the Mexicans were in the pool, it was closed down and cleaned.
Mm-hmm. That was in Harlingen, actually.
Yeah.
And it was just crazy how that could have happened because, you know, how you read about they lived on the other side of the railroad tracks. They literally did. On one side of the railroad tracks, the streets are all named after the presidents of the United States. On the other side of the railroad tracks where my mother grew up, they had letters, A Street, B Street, C Street, as if they couldn't read on the other side of the railroad tracks. But my grandfather, he owned the first mercantile store in downtown Harlingen and was one of the signers of the charter of Harlingen, and yet still had to live on the wrong side of the tracks. They lived on B Street. Mm. And then the kids were going to a school that was not well-equipped, didn't have the desks, didn't have textbooks and good, you know, teachers that were educated. So there's lots of stories in the family, but one is of my grandfather taking my mother's brothers and sisters to the school and demanding that they put them in the Anglo school where they had better books and desks and teachers.
You know, again, education, you are a huge, you know, backer of education. But I'm wondering now, even speaking to Dr. Garcia, I'm willing to bet that there are many Americans who, especially of late, are only hearing from Mexicans or Mexican-Americans as they cross a border, as they struggle with English as a second language. That's the image that we see. We're hearing you. We're hearing your education. We're hearing your parents, you know, through you, pushing for that education. I mean, how important is that, that all Americans hear your voice and hear this possibility that your one brother is a scientist or a computer expert or something, and one became a doctor, and, you know, that it was all about education.
I have never met a gardener or a maintenance worker that didn't understand that his children or her children would be better off with an education. They know what life is without an education. And so when I would talk to some of our gardeners on campus and ask for them or say something like, you know, it's so hot out here, I'm so sorry you're having to do this. And they'd look at me like, I have a job. And my daughter's in college, or my daughter's working on a master's, or my son's going to law school. And they all started out in the valley at our school. So you don't have to convince poor people who have never had an education, how relevant, how important and vital it is for their livelihood.
Well, and I'm just struck by how many waves of immigration there have been, you know, historically, Italian, Polish, in which it was thought that people could not achieve. And then that wave educates the second wave, and suddenly that question is gone.
It's gone in my family alone. And I mean my father's, my mother's family, all of their children, all of my cousins, all of them did well. I mean, there's not a non-professional one in the bunch. And when we would convene, you know, for a wedding or a funeral, my father would say, give me something to brag about. And it wasn't, you know, what kind of car you drove or what kind of house you had. It was, how have you been doing in school? So we would have to sit there and conjure up something to tell Dad, because everybody understood how tough life had been without an education. And their kids were not going to go through that. Mm.
Well, Dr. Julieta Garcia, I know your dad passed a day before you became the youngest and first Latino president of the University of Texas, Brownsville. But you sure have given him something to brag about now.
Well, thank you. He guided us. Imagine having to raise three kids as a single parent.
Well, you are now one of 17 Americans receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much, and thank you for focusing on the important stories that you do.
So, Robin, let us talk about salad.
Oh, grown lettuce. Let us talk about, I see what you did there.
You'll never stop me. My son came home with another gem yesterday. I've always had a stepladder, never knew my real ladder. On to the day job. Resident Chef Kathy Gunst is here, and that is important. Summer salad recipes. Hello, Kathy.
I'm still laughing over that one. Yeah. Took me a second. Hello to both of you.
Hi. And, you know, Kathy, these are great. We're going to try to keep the puns to a minimum, but these Good. Recipes are great for people going, salad? No, these are not, you know, your grandma's half a head of iceberg lettuce with blue cheese, although that is terrific.
There is nothing wrong with
that. Nothing wrong with that, but so much variety here.
Yeah, that was the idea. I wanted to think outside the box. Sometimes people really have an awfully limited, you know, vision of a salad. Oh, you know, cut up a head of lettuce, put some dressing on it, call it a day. No, that's not what we're going to do here. The first one is entirely grilled, and I am so in love with this recipe. I am thinking about doing it again tonight. I took a fillet of salmon, and then I also took what's called radicchio, which is a bitter type of chicory, very beautiful maroon and white, and a lemon cut in half, and I put some olive oil on all of them, and I throw them on the grill. You flip the radicchio over till it softens, the salmon cooks till it's done, and the lemon gets a kind of burnt, caramelized deliciousness on the halves. You then take all of this off the fire. You thinly slice the radicchio, put it on a platter, cut the salmon into thick slices, sprinkle it with fresh dill and chives. Then you squeeze that barbecued grilled lemon on top, a little olive oil, and then a lot of pitted green and black olives, and you've got this great salty, crunchy, sour, sweet, savory salad.
Oh, what a combination. Kathy, any suggestions for grilling salmon specifically? Flipping salmon? Now, we use one where it's skin side down and there's no flipping. I'm kind of flipping averse because I'm not very good at it.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't have to. And skin side down is absolutely the way to go. If you put the skin side down and you're grill is clean, it won't stick. And then if you have a really wide spatula, you can get it up. You can just flip it for 2 to 3 minutes and flip it back over because that crispy skin is yum.
You've just revealed so much about yourself, Scott. Flipping averse.
It's flipping averse. We can talk about that later.
That's a whole other topic.
Yes, right.
On to the next recipe. Kathy, you have mango avocado chicken salad. I love all of this together. What brought you to it?
I saw four mangoes for $3 at the store, and I thought, oh, fresh mango. And then I had a ripe avocado, and I had a cucumber from the garden, and I thought, okay, let's do something with sort of really bright, almost tropical summer flavors, perfect for a hot summer night. So I cubed the mango, tossed it lightly with cucumber, avocado, lime, cilantro, and if you have leftover chicken, add it. If not, you can keep it all vegetarian. And then the dressing is so just refreshing. Fresh ginger, cilantro, mint, and lime juice, and olive oil. And then you add crunchy salted peanuts on top. Again, building colors and textures.
Can I just say, cilantro is such a fragile little thing. If you don't pay attention to it, every single second, it just, I mean, my pots are all, the cilantro is just all gone.
I know, you have to water
them all the time. I'm just saying. Okay, I'm sorry. Scott,
okay, Kathy,
continue.
I have two process questions here because I love this recipe. One is, could you add a little kick to that mango avocado chicken salad, a pepper or something?
Absolutely. A little chopped red chili, jalapeno, a splash of hot sauce. Excellent idea. Yes.
Okay.
What's
and
the other
avocados,
technique? Yes.
Avocados and mangoes are, of course, both fruits with big pits.
Yes.
Techniques for dealing with avocados and mangoes, because, I sharpen my knife with a mango, but I'm a little scared also.
Yeah, you needn't be. You hold the mango upright, you take your knife, and you slice down the side till you can just touch the pit and cut right down that on both sides. So you'll have these two halves. And you then just make a tic-tac-toe with your knife onto the mango flesh and push them out from the skin. And then you can just cut off whatever is still clinging to the pit and then chew on that pit and get all that gorgeous juice. Avocados, simple. Take a sharp knife, go all the way around or just halfway, and then you can use your knife to pull the pit out and cut it however you like.
Okay. And we have less than a minute here, but I want to get to, it's not a typo when you get to the website where all of these will be, green salad.
Yes, I challenged myself. I wanted to make a simple summer salad that used only green ingredients. So I found a gorgeous crunchy romaine at the farmer's market. I had lots of early summer peas in my garden. I sauteed a green zucchini. I added celery, mint, and chives. And then in my blender, I whirled up a green goddess dressing with a ton of herbs, avocado, and yogurt.
Oh boy. You could throw in the grass from the yard. Kathy Gunn, our Here Now resident chef. We'll have everything at herenow.org. Fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy.
And
thanks, Kathy.
Yep. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.